From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. The country's top general apologized today for standing with the president for a photo op last week near the White House, moments after the National Guard forcefully cleared the area. Mark Milley, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said it created a perception that the military was involved in domestic politics. We'll have more on that in a few moments.
But first, both parties say Congress needs to pass police reform legislation. But what kind? Ohio Representative Jim Jordan is ranking Republican on the House Judiciary Committee, which yesterday heard testimony on racial profiling and police brutality. He's shepherding GOP plans for police reform in the House. So, Congressman Jordan, first, your thoughts on the moment that brought us here when you saw that tape of George Floyd being killed.
It's a tragedy. It never should have happened. As I said yesterday in the hearing, it's as wrong can be. Speaking to Mr. Floyd's brother yesterday, said that George Floyd's killers are going to face justice, and we hope it's as swift as possible. And I said the same thing to Miss Underwood Jacob about her brother, Pat, who lost his life with rioters, attacked him in Oakland, and as a federal officer was killed there. That is as wrong can be, and never should have happened. His killers are going to face justice as well.
Very sad. A drive-by shooting of a federal security guard. Officials are still investigating if it was related to the protests, but all the unrest was ignited by the killing of George Floyd. And Congressman Jordan, Democrats say they are responding. Their plan calls for tracking and prosecuting police misconduct, restricting the use of deadly force, and a ban on chokeholds. Right now, there's a patchwork of bans across the country. Republican Senator Tim Scott, leading the Senate plan, says he shares the Democrats' goal of banning chokeholds, but wants more data, to which Democrats say, what more do you need to know? Will you have a chokehold ban in your plan?
We're working with Senator Scott. We're working with everyone, frankly. We've talked with folks at the Department of Justice, folks at the White House, and we're talking with Democrats. I mean, I thought the tone of yesterday's hearing was pretty darn good. We don't know when the legislation will be finalized, but Senator Scott is doing a lot of work and has a lot of good things in his bill that I think many members on the House side appreciate.
Well, yeah, and you just expressed sympathy earlier about someone who lost an officer, and you're talking to someone who has a beloved relative who is a police officer.
Yep.
Many who do feel that part of what this is about making it safer for police officers by getting rid of things like chokeholds. So will you have a chokehold ban?
We're looking at that concept and may, in fact, be in the legislation. Like I said, we're talking to everyone, and you're right.
It may be.
Well, many departments have already gotten rid of that that technique as well. So that's something that, again, we're talking with everyone. This idea you're hearing from the left about defunding the police is the most insane, ridiculous public policy proposal I have ever heard. So those.
Well, let's take that up for a second, because we have sound from yesterday. In yesterday's hearing, you took time to criticize what you said was Democrats refusing to speak out against calls to defund the police. Let's listen to you.
It is pure insanity to defund the police. And the fact that my Democrat colleagues won't speak out against this crazy policy is just that frightening.
But Congressman, top names have spoken out. Let's listen.
No, I don't support defunding the police.
I don't believe that you should disband police departments.
That's Democratic Representative Karen Bass. She's taking the lead on police reform legislation. Before that, of course, Joe Biden. And there are many other voices who have said we're not for defunding the police. Some cities are talking about less militarization money, taking some money from police and moving it back to departments like social work and removing from police the burden of doing some of this extra work they're doing. And Congressman Jordan, it sounds like you were throwing a match where there's no wood. Why would
not
you say
it.
That?
Robin, the mayors of the two largest cities in our country have both been for defunding the police. The Democrat Party started off this Congress. They started this Congress off by saying they were going to abolish ICE. Then they said, no, we're going to abolish the Department of Homeland Security. And now they're saying we're going to defund and abolish police departments. The mayors of the two largest cities, Mayor de Blasio and Mayor Garcetti, have both said they want to defund the police. And in Minneapolis, they have a veto-proof majority on their city council who has said they want to abolish the police department.
You said no Democrats have spoken out against it. And there's many more. Jim Clyburn told his colleagues, don't be distracted by defunding.
The squad is using it as a way to raise money for Democrats in the upcoming election. It's a three-word sentence. Defund the police. If it's not about defunding the police, then I would change the sentence.
You said no Democrats, and so we were asking you about that comment, which isn't true. Look, Congressman Jordan, There are reports that you and other Republicans have been kind of caught on your back foot here, that you were unprepared for this moment in history. And you have been saying to us that there's going to be a plan, but are you going to have the plan by Friday as promised?
Didn't promise a plan by Friday, but we are working on putting together legislation, and we're working with the people I've talked about, and we will continue to do that. I think this is an important enough issue, Robin, not to do it fast, but to get it right. You know, it might have been nice if the Democrats actually talked to us before they introduced their bill. They didn't want to do that. But we're going to work with everyone to try to do what's best for the American people.
Members of the Trump administration have said they don't believe there's any systemic racism in U.S. law enforcement, but the data belies that. And 70% of Americans feel that George Floyd's killing is part of a bigger systemic problem. President Trump spent time this week spreading a falsehood about an elderly protester. Do you worry that your party, the party of Lincoln, and has a chance now to reclaim that title, has the wrong leader for this moment?
No, President Trump has been an outstanding leader. This president, the First Step Act, that's one of the biggest prison reforms done in history. This president has the economic, prior to the coronavirus, what we had done economically with the lowest unemployment in 50 years in this country that was helping all Americans. This president has been an outstanding leader on so many issues, and I appreciate that, and I think the American people appreciate that, and they appreciate the vision he laid out a week and a half ago where he talked about healing, not hatred, where he talked about justice, not chaos. That is what we want.
Ohio's Jim Jordan, the ranking Republican member of the Judiciary Committee. Congressman Jordan, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Robin.
And there's a lot more political news to follow out of Washington. We have with us NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. And Domenico, let's start with the country's top general, Mark Milley. He apologized today for appearing alongside President Trump at that photo op last week near the White House. And Milley stood in uniform outside a church just after the National Guard and police used force to clear protesters from the area. How significant is his apology?
You know, it's pretty significant. I mean, he said that he didn't think that he should be there. And I can't remember seeing this kind of a break with a commander in chief and military officials this publicly. You know, the military tries to stay apolitical. It's one of the institutions with the highest level of trust and confidence in the country. I mean, routinely, about 3/4 of Americans say they have a great deal or quite a lot of confidence in the military, if you look at Gallup polling. And it's important to mention that a significant share of the military is African American, slightly less than 1 in 5. They've been hearing it, frankly, officers and top brass from those troops, and they don't want to break that trust with, you know, people in the ranks and with the American public and become embroiled in a racial controversy the way the police have.
We'll definitely be watching for the president's response to this apology. I want to ask you about something else. So yesterday, President Trump said that he opposes renaming military bases named after Confederate generals. What's been the reaction to this?
We had the Army Secretary and even the Defense Secretary say that they're open to holding a, quote, bipartisan conversation on whether to rename them, to take the names down, etc. But President Trump himself has taken a hard line against that, tweeting about, not wanting to, one, explicitly rename them, but also not wanting to repeat the mistakes of history, that you should remember history and all that. But behind the scenes on Capitol Hill, it appears that there's at least a little bit of movement for considering this. Elizabeth Warren, senator from Massachusetts, introduced an amendment to the Defense Authorization Bill saying it's long past time to end the tribute to white supremacy on our military installations. And the Republican-led Senate Armed Services Committee took up that amendment behind closed doors.
The president is visiting Dallas, Texas today to discuss economic health and justice disparities. Has he proposed any concrete ideas for addressing police reform?
You know, he hasn't yet. He's really talked about law and order. That's what he's really talked about. Even yesterday on Capitol Hill, representatives from the Trump administration, like Dan Bongino, a former New York City police officer and now works with the president or advises the president, very strongly in endorsing and supporting the police. It said that the administration, the White House, is working on an executive order behind the scenes. It's unclear what that'll say. And, you know, Trump has this balancing act that he has to do when, you know, it's hard to erase his history on race. I mean, this is someone who took out a full page ad on the Central Park Five, and said that Mexicans are sending rapists to the country. So, you know, it's not something you can easily erase with an executive order.
Poll numbers are coming out. They're showing that the president's numbers are down. How has his campaign responded to this?
Well, to say that the polls are wrong and even ask CNN to apologize for showing Trump not doing well, it really takes me back to this debate that was being had in 2012, where there was a group called Unskew the Polls, which, frankly, they were people who either didn't know how polls worked or were dishonest about methodologies. And that's happening again. The president has a pollster with not a very good track record. And, you know, look, you've heard this trite cliche before, but it's true that the only poll that truly matters is the one on Election Day.
That's NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Thanks as always.
Hey, you're welcome.
Today in Richmond, Virginia, the former capital of the Confederacy, there is one less controversial statue standing. Protesters late last night toppled the statue of Confederate President Jefferson Davis on Monument Avenue. And this comes after Virginia Governor Ralph Northam said the state would remove another nearby statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee as soon as possible. What's going on in Richmond is just one example of how the debate over Confederate statues has reignited as people throughout the country re-examine racial inequality. And now we're going to take a deeper look at the significance of the violence we've witnessed at some of these ongoing protests. At the onset of the unrest, when people started burning cars and destroying property, some argued that the nonviolent protest movement of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. should be the model for today's activists. But our next guest says violence has long been a part of bringing about racial justice. Kelly Carter Jackson is a professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College and author of the new book, Force and Freedom, Black Abolitionists and the Politics of Violence. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with this argument we hear being made sometimes that Martin Luther King Jr. preached nonviolence. So perhaps there is no place for violence in today's fight for justice. What do you say to that?
Oh, man, I push back on that pretty hard. I think that the entire civil rights movement was a movement, an organized movement in response to violence. That the entire movement was about violence and how people should respond to it. And when I talk about violence, I talk about the murder of Emmett Till. I talk about the murder of four little girls in a church, or the assassination of Medgar Evers, of Malcolm X, or Martin Luther King Jr. himself. This movement was rife with violence. And I think that deserves a thorough examination. And I think it's that something that needs to be discussed when we talk about the civil rights movement. I think we've been too comfortable about looking back at this past with sort of rose-colored glasses about how people responded to their oppression.
You say that violence goes all the way back in the founding of the United States. And the death of Crispus Attucks, the first person, a black man killed at the Boston Massacre. Can you talk more about that?
Sure. So I live in the Boston area. And if you do, you know that K through 12 students are all introduced to Crispus Attucks. I would say across the nation, when we are discussing the American Revolution, one of the first names we learn is that of Crispus Attucks, because he is believed to be the first casualty of the American Revolution. And so we talk about him as a patriot, but what we don't really discuss is the fuller story of that moment, that Crispus Attucks was, throwing rocks, some people say snowballs, some people say pieces of wood. But nevertheless, an altercation ensued, and when British soldiers fired and killed Crispus Attucks and several others, these British soldiers were brought to trial, and our former president, John Adams, defended them. And the way he did that was by essentially pulling the race card, by saying, look at Crispus Attucks, this black man, this mulatto, this tall, terrifying man. Of course, the British soldiers would be in fear for their lives. And when I started reading the court documents, I was like, oh my gosh, this language is so similar to the language that we use today when we talk about cops who were in fear for their lives, or why someone may have taken this violent response. And so I realized that this, what we're looking at, is actually not new at all. It's actually quite old.
Hmm. Early abolitionists espoused the idea of moral suasion, that being the idea that you could just talk slave owners into freeing their slaves by convincing them it was wrong. I mean, how did that go?
Not so well. You know, I think that if we think about it in the moment, you know, in the 1830s, they're experiencing the Second Great Awakening. So it's this religious revival going all across the country where people believe that, you know, Christ is going to return, that he's going to come back, and that he better not come back and find you a slaveholder, right? That slavery is a sin. It is something that we should repent of. It is a moral crime. And so abolitionists thought that they could really use moral suasion to persuade slaveholders into freeing their slaves. What they didn't realize, or maybe what they didn't appreciate, was the economic stronghold that the institution of slavery had on this country, and that it was going to be nearly impossible to convince anyone to forfeit their economic well-being, let alone their power and political power at that.
I want to ask you about something else. Most of these protests have been peaceful, but there have been violent incidents, including rioting and looting. Is there any way to see looting as beneficial to the overall cause of social justice, or should we purely be looking at this as an opportunism?
Oh, you know, it's complicated. That's the short answer. I say yes and no, in the sense that I think that we have looked at looters and we have looked at overturned cars or destroyed businesses, and we have put too much attention on them by putting the destruction of property on par with the destruction of Black people, with the death of George Floyd. I don't think that's right at all. I don't think you should ever compare people and property. That's exactly what happened in slavery. On the other hand, I do think that if we're not careful and if we don't listen to the fact that people are angry and that people are enraged, and if we don't respond to the violence that we're seeing, not necessarily with law and order and tanks and guns, but if we don't respond with real systemic change, then we are doomed to repeat this cycle over and over again. You know, a lot of people have been using the MLK quote, which is a riot is the language of the unheard. And I think that if we're not careful in this moment to really listen and to really learn about these grievances and why people are so upset, we will find ourselves here again in another 5 or 10 years.
We've been hearing from allies who have been speaking very directly about the need for change and acknowledging systemic racism. You've talked quite a bit about the importance of knowing your history, and specifically Black history. Do you also see this a moment in time where we may be rethinking the way we educate our young people about the origins of this country and systemic racism?
Absolutely. You know, I really hope that we are moving into a moment where African-American history is not treated as an elective, but a requirement. I think it should be something that everyone knows and learns and understands. I think that in addition to learning, we have a lot of unlearning to do. We have been given really problematic versions of history and really problematic versions of other ethnic groups, and that we have to work through to really unlearn. You know, a perfect example, I think, is I'm conflicted by this because my son's school is trying to talk about these issues, and he's 6. And, you know, they were trying to give him a storybook. And in the storybook, it was about how this girl who was brown was being discriminated against and no one would play with her because she was brown. And the moral of the story was skin color doesn't matter, and that she should be played with. But I realized that in telling that story, we also sort of subconsciously reinforce these ideas of difference, so that children who may have been unaware of the politics of skin color are now aware that this is a problem, right? And so, you know, children were presented with the narrative of, here's a little white girl and she's been tormented for her white skin and her blonde hair. That was not the story. It was the story is, here's a Black girl where her skin color is the problem. That's the, you know, the overall message, or I would say the subconscious message that children will internalize, even when you tell them that this is wrong. The understanding is, or the starting point is, people believe this is right.
Do you see this moment as different?
I do see this moment as different. I mean, I live in the town of Wellesley, which is very white and affluent, and I have seen more Black Lives Matter signs than Black people. And, you know, I do think that there is a different feel or texture about this current protest movement, who you see protesting, how you see them protesting, and the quick response to making reform has been sort of mind-blowing. But I think the real change will happen in, you know, what do police departments look like going forward? If we're just talking about police reform and police brutality, will these four officers involved in Minneapolis, will they be held accountable? Will they get probation? Will they get a prison sentence? Will it be 2 years? Will it be 20 years? You know, how these officers are held accountable, I think will say a lot. But also being able to create real structural, systemic, lasting, sustaining change is what's going to take this beyond the protest and into a better future if we're willing to do the work.
Professor Kelly Carter Jackson is the author of Force and Freedom, Black Abolitionists and the Politics of Violence. Professor Carter Jackson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Want to add more positivity to your podcast feed? Check out Kind World, stories of extraordinary kindness and compassion.
That's Kind World. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
The World Health Organization has warned that the coronavirus pandemic is accelerating in Africa. So far, Africa has been the continent least affected by COVID-19, with just over 200,000 cases, fewer than 6,000 deaths across the continent. But the WHO's regional director now expects those numbers to rise, with one country, South Africa, accounting for more than a quarter of the entire continent's cases. Let's bring in Andrew Harding in Johannesburg, South Africa. Andrew, some have warned the situation in Cape Province, which is home to Cape Town, is starting to look similar to Europe. Describe that.
Robin, that's right. Yes, Cape Town, the Western Cape at the very southern tip of the continent, it looks like the epicenter at the moment. And doctors are worried that their hospitals in a pretty well-resourced part of the country are going to be overwhelmed within the next week or two. There's also growing concern about the Eastern Cape. It's a much poorer part of the country. And the feeling is that that region is going to very soon be overrun by the virus. And the real concern there is that the Eastern Cape could act, if you like, as an indicator of the way the rest of the continent might head.
Yeah, well, this is so interesting because here in the States, just this morning, we were seeing reporting that perhaps the caseload on the continent, the whole continent, was lower because there's a younger population and less hypertension, for instance. But now we're hearing that the exact opposite might happen. How did this happen? Because South Africa had a very strict lockdown early on.
It's very complicated, and the data really isn't here yet to make these generalizations about the continent. South Africa, like a lot of African countries, when it saw what was happening in Europe and Asia, it had a bit of advance warning, if you like, because the virus was slow to penetrate this continent. But I think the feeling now is that those lockdowns have helped. They've bought governments time, but the virus is getting through anyway. And while we have a pretty clear indication of what's happening in South Africa, because it's a wealthy country relatively with a lot of testing, what we don't know is what's going on in an awful lot of Africa. And so people are in the dark.
Yeah, well, let's zoom out from South Africa. The WHO warned that COVID-19 could spread beyond major population centers. And so how are health officials preparing for that?
Well, they've a lot of experience here in Africa in dealing with this kind of threat. These are countries and health systems that, by and large, are pretty much ready to deal with this. And they've been able to ramp up coverage. They've been putting out a lot of community health workers to test people. The problem is, though, of course, is still there's a lack of resourcing. And there is also, I think it's an important point, people across Africa, by and large, do not engage with their health services as much as they do perhaps in Europe, because they worry that if they go to hospital, perhaps they'll die. They don't trust the health system. So it may well be that people are choosing to die at home, to suffer at home. What people look back to is 2009, a huge swine flu outbreak around the world. And it seemed like Africa and India were unaffected. And then they waited a year or two and did proper research into the data. And they discovered that actually more than half of all deaths happened in Africa, happened in India. It's just that nobody noticed, because people were dying in poor communities, far away from data collection. And I think that's the feeling that that could well happen again this time.
The BBC's Andrew Harding in Johannesburg, South Africa. Andrew, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And we reached Andrew on Skype.
The CDC is reporting a dip in the number of children who are getting routine vaccines during this pandemic. And there's concern about what this could mean for public health. Joining us now is Yvonne Maldonado. She is a professor of pediatrics at Stanford University School of Medicine. Professor Maldonado, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Yes. So can you give us a sense of the numbers? How widespread are you seeing parents actually delaying vaccines for their children?
Yeah. So, for example, in Michigan, there was a study that was put together by Angela Shen and other colleagues in May that looked at the Michigan registry, a vaccination registry, and they demonstrated a more than about a 50% decline or more among most children's immunizations over the period from March 23rd until May. So really in 2 months, a 50% or more reduction. And then more recently, there were data from something called VFC, which is a national program called Vaccines for Children. That's a program that funds, provides government funds to provide vaccinations for children in the United States who might not otherwise be able to afford them. And in that program, that's a substantial number of doses that are given. We saw, especially from the end of March to the middle of April, a major reduction, you know, 50% or more fold reduction in the number of vaccine doses ordered. Those are usually pretty good indicators of what kids are getting.
You mentioned the measles vaccine. What vaccinations are you most concerned about that kids might be missing?
So, for example, the measles vaccine is critical for a couple of reasons. One is it causes severe disease in the youngest children. So the most complications and deaths from measles in children worldwide occur in children under a year of age. But the other problem with measles is that it is a highly transmissible virus. So you need to keep the vaccination levels and the herd immunity, as we've heard about, really high. It needs to be at least 90 to 95% to really keep outbreaks from happening. And we just pulled ourselves out of a massive measles set of outbreaks in the U.S. and around the world because of vaccination reductions. So that's one area. But then we have other vaccines like the pneumococcal vaccine, which is a vaccine that prevents a bacteria from spreading in children that actually can cause severe meningitis. And there is another one that's very similar, called the Haemophilus influenza vaccine. The same thing, causes severe meningitis. But those also can cause things like pneumonia and ear infections. So they run the gamut, but they are all critical vaccines. Now, one could say that, well, you know, we'll catch them up later. But what we know about these vaccine schedules is they're done in this way for a reason. We are vaccinating the children at the ages when they are most susceptible to these diseases. So if we wait, these children may actually wind up getting infected at a time when they're most vulnerable if they haven't received the vaccine. The second issue is we worry about being able to get everybody their catch-up vaccinations. And that's why the schedules are so well organized. And if every pediatrician or pediatric provider really knows how to provide these on a schedule that will keep everybody up to date and in an efficient fashion. Once you start giving vaccines in a helter-skelter fashion, you wind up missing children.
So what advice would you have? You know, one thing that we have been hearing, our parents concerned during this pandemic of going out to a medical facility to see a doctor. And so that also plays a role in some of the reasons why some parents have decided to hold off. What kind of precautions do doctors' offices have in place to keep kids safe from COVID-19 while they're getting their vaccinations?
Well, that's a great question. Well, you know, again, pediatricians have been talking about this since the beginning of the pandemic. And of course, as healthcare providers, they are going to be much more careful than the general public around not only keeping their patients safe, but their staff safe. And if people are concerned, I think they should call their provider. They should ask their provider, what are you doing to keep me safe? What should I be worried about? And talk to them about it if they are worried. In particular, we also want to make sure that children under 2 years of age are most likely to get their vaccines. And the one piece of encouraging news that we saw in the reduction of vaccines administered since March is that actually of the reductions, the biggest reductions happened in children over 2 years of age. So even though kids under two were not as likely to get their full vaccination as they were before the pandemic, the proportion not getting vaccinated was better for the children under two. So we really want to make sure that children are protected because we already have one pandemic and we would not want to see more infectious disease outbreaks on top of this one because we think, you know, for example, with flu season coming and respiratory virus season coming, we don't want to see more children getting sick with other organisms as well as this this particular virus.
That's Yvonne Maldonado. She's a professor of pediatrics at Stanford University School of Medicine. Professor Maldonado, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Now, there was already an issue with parents opting out of vaccines in the Seattle area before this pandemic, and parents there tried a hyper-local approach to talk to each other about the benefits. Let's bring in one of those mothers and educators now, Jessica Booth, who lives in Kirkland, Washington. Jessica, what did you learn from your time volunteering to do outreach about vaccine education that could be helpful today?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing I took away from being a parent advocate for vaccinations was to listen. We reassure. We have really open and honest communication with each other. I think conversations on some of these hard topics go well when we're calm and we know that we want to do the best that we can do and that sometimes when we try to just jam facts down people's throats, that doesn't really get someone to understand better. We really just need to be an advocate for the benefits that they can provide.
You note that you yourself, when it comes to a vaccination for coronavirus, you're not 100% pro-vaccine. You still are critical about each decision you make for your children. For example, as I mentioned, you have a lot of questions before you decide to vaccinate your children for COVID-19, if there is a vaccine for it that comes soon. What comes to mind for you?
Yeah, I definitely think vaccinations have a huge place for our society. They have a lot of importance. And when we're looking at things like polio and measles, those risks are pretty clear. Those are no-brainers in my book for me, for our family. When we're looking at something like a new vaccination, like something that would come out for COVID-19, my husband and I would definitely weigh the risks and benefits to that. And so I couldn't say at this point in time that 100% that I would vaccinate my children with that, just because I'm not sure that the risks outweigh the benefits.
Yeah. There's so many unknowns right now. I mean, you know, it's just a tough time for families overall.
Yeah. There's so much. I mean, parenting was hard in the first place. it's a hard gig to be a parent right now. And I'm definitely battling the COVID situation and schools being shut down and schooling our kids at home, maybe working from home. All of these factors are just adding more stressors. And then, gosh, when am I going to get my kiddo to the clinic? How am I going to get them vaccinated in a timely fashion? Or those are just more challenges that we're facing right now.
But you say challenges that are worth it for really the greater good of your child and for society, as we see firsthand something like COVID-19 really spread because we don't have a vaccine.
Yeah, I do think our generation of parents, we haven't seen what it looks like to have a polio outbreak or a measles outbreak in such a huge detrimental way. And I think without sometimes seeing that, it can be easy to forget what these vaccinations are meant to do.
That's Jessica Booth. She's a parent in Kirkland, Washington, who was a former volunteer for a vaccine education outreach effort in the state. Jessica, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
If you need to know that this moment in American history may be a little different from other spasms of anger, you may have Exhibit A today. NASCAR announced yesterday that fans won't be able to fly the Confederate flag at races anymore, saying the flag runs contrary to our commitment to providing a welcoming and inclusive environment for all fans, our competitors, and our industry. Bubba Wallace, NASCAR's only full-time black driver, celebrated the move by wearing an I Can't Breathe shirt and having his car painted with the words Black Lives Matter. But at least one other driver announced he's leaving the sport over the change. Mike Pesca is here now as a sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. He joins us. And Mike, do you agree that, you know, this ban seems like a big deal?
Well, it is a big deal. And after the shooting in South Carolina, the slaughter there five years ago, NASCAR tried, not a ban, but to gently urge fans, or perhaps more than gently urge fans, not to bring Confederate flags. They removed it from all of their official merchandise, and the message was put forward, please don't bring Confederate flags to our events. And Dale Earnhardt and others spoke out against it. But at that time, and in fact, at one event in the vexillological version of a gun buyback program, they announced that anyone who had a Confederate flag could exchange it at the event for an American flag, but it seemed like no one took them up on that. And it died. The effort to ask fans not to bring Confederate flags died. Now they are making it a ban. Times are different now. And I suppose they are risking some blowback within their community of core fans. And yet when I look around on social media, and maybe this is, you know, a selective group, but even when I read the NASCAR Facebook page, there are a lot of people, a lot of self-identified NASCAR fans who are saying, finally, the time has come.
Well, and you mentioned the Charleston incident. That, of course, was when the white supremacist murdered the black worshipers at the church there in 2015. He was pictured with a Confederate flag. A picture surfaced, and that's when they first said, please don't bring them. But others, including, you know, Dale Earnhardt, as you say, have been asking, please do this. And we know the flag is embraced by people who say it represents their forefathers who died on battlefields in the Civil War, but those battles were pro-slavery. Same argument about bases like Fort Bragg. You know, why should blacks have to train at a base that was named after a racist general like Bragg? But this has become something that people can carry with them. And another driver, Ray Ciccarelli, said he's leaving. You talk about backlash in a Facebook post that he later deleted. He said he doesn't believe in taking away fans' rights to fly whatever flag they love. You say you're not seeing other backlash, but, you know, are they doing this just on moral grounds? Because when I occasionally see a race on TV, I don't think I see any black faces there. I mean, it doesn't seem like they're doing it to get people to come to the race. You know, why do you think they're doing this?
Right. So a couple of things. There is some backlash, and Ciccarelli is, I think, trying to capitalize on it. Just some context about him. He drives in something called the NASCAR Gander RV and Outdoor Truck Series. So the way NASCAR is structured, that's essentially the second tier of minor leagues in the NASCAR racing. There's the Cup Series, which are the nationally televised events we all see. There's the Xfinity Series. And then down below, there's this Truck Series. And he's extremely unsuccessful in the Truck Series. Through 18 races over 3 years, he only finished in the top 10 once and never won. And he's 50. So it seems that this is a guy who, is it that he's leaving the sport or the sport has essentially left him and he's making some sort of defiant statement on the way out? Why is this changing now? I don't think that it's because to placate fans who are black within it. I think it's because they're reading where society is going and know that they can't be positioned as just a white-only entertainment and also a casually racist form of entertainment. It's untenable in this day and age.
Yeah, just quickly, because I know you want to talk about LeBron James, the NBA star, among the black athletes forming a voting rights group called More Than a Vote. Just your sense of what's going on there.
LeBron James is extremely popular and famous, as we know. The New York Times story breaking this noted that he has 136 million social media followers and 137 million Americans voted last election. So he's teaming up with other athletes like Jalen Rose and Skylar Diggins-Smith to really emphasize voting and voting rights. And he harkens back to Muhammad Ali and Bill Russell and Oscar Robertson and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar as athletes doing the right thing in a time of crisis to rally people and their followers to vote.
Okay. And some we know some pro football athletes have been speaking out as well. Mike Pesca here now is a sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thank you.
You're welcome.
And Tanya Mosley, there in Los Angeles. Yeah. I think you are scheduled to speak with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Oh, yes. Tomorrow we'll have a discussion with him. I'm excited to share it with folks.
Cannot wait. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now.